This is Politics and Media 101. I'm Jeff Browning. Isaac Saul is the founder of Tangle, an independent, ad-free, nonpartisan outlet where he summarizes the best arguments on the left and right about the news of the day. We all know that the media is polarized, yet we all still consume it. The outlets we read and hear, perhaps too often, make money off validating what we already believe, raising questions about ethics and journalism, and about what consumers should seek and should value in a free media whose job it is to expose the truth. Amid this tumultuous and brave new world, Isaac has built one of the most impactful and successful newsletters on the internet, where he delivers his thoughts and observations directly to readers' inboxes, the same way we try to deliver people like Isaac to your podcast feed. As a reminder, like all of our episodes, this is an edited version of a longer conversation that was taped live with audience questions. For information about how to join us and past episodes, please visit our website, pm101.live. Please also take a second to subscribe so you don't miss our next episode coming this Monday featuring Mvemba Dizolale, who's the director of the Africa program at CSIS. Without any further ado, let's roll the tape.
How did you decide to get into journalism? What was that process like?
My original background in journalism was actually as a sports reporter at the University of Pittsburgh. And pretty much by my last semester, my senior year, I knew that I wanted to write about something a little bit more meaningful to me personally, that I felt like had more relevance to the things that were happening around me on campus and in my home state of Pennsylvania. When I left school, I started looking for a political journalism job. And I actually got my first gig ever at the Huffington Post, which, as most people listening probably know, has a reputation for being a bit of a left-wing. This sort of, you know, this was back in 2013, 2014, I think, before a lot of people really understood the media bubbles that they were living in, that the internet was putting us in, that social media channels were putting us in. And so I went through 6 or 7, 8 years, basically, of working in the political media space and basically seeing over and over and over again whether I was writing something for a conservative news outlet or a liberal news outlet or somewhere, something kind of down the middle, that I was only going to reach an audience that already was kind of predisposed to the kind of story selections those outlets were leaning into. And I could pretty much predict whether my stories were going to break through or have an impact based on where they were being published, because I knew whether people would, you know, engage them, share them, or they would just ignore them, basically. And so I came up with this concept to start a news outlet where I was trying to bring people with a really diverse set of political views under one roof, create something that they could trust, whether they were conservative or liberal or somewhere in between. I think one of the really interesting things that I've learned from doing my work is that your audience can, in really profound ways, reinforce and shape your own political views and the things you decide to say, the things you decide not to say. And it's a really, really tricky thing to navigate. I mean, I see it now with a lot of kind of the more heterodox writers that are popping up on places like Substack, who I think are sort of starting to just produce some of the same kinds of stories, just repackaged in different ways, whether they're media criticisms or criticisms of the right or criticisms of the left. And they're just doing it because they're feeding the beast of their audience. They know what they like. And by doing it and sort of doing that exercise every single time, they kind of reinforce their own political views. They shape their own political views. And I think, you know, Ariana certainly is someone who sort of found this niche, found something that worked, and she sort of evolved as it blossomed, which is a really interesting phenomenon.
You talked about how at the beginning of your career, you were writing about sports, but you found yourself writing about politics as you wrote about sports, because these two things do intersect so often. What were some of the stories that you were reporting on in the sports world that had this surprising political component that you think, you know, maybe people should recognize to the extent that they don't quite do yet?
One of the very first pieces that I wrote that ever really blew up when I was there was about Richard Sherman, who is a cornerback in the NFL and at the time was playing for the Seattle Seahawks and very famously, you know, made a game-winning play at the end of the game. And then in a post-game presser or a post-game interview, really, he was still on the field in his pads. You know, a reporter stuck a mic in his face and he talked a little smack about how, you know, the receiver he was guarding was trash and nobody could stop him and he was the best cornerback in the league. And then that night and into the next day, there was just this like really weird commentary that came up out of this whole exchange where, you know, he was being called a thug on all these national television programs. People were saying he was a disgrace to the game. And I sort of wrote this piece that was just like, this guy, I mean, if you ever read about Richard Sherman, unfortunately for my piece in terms of how it's aged, in the last year or two, he's actually gotten into some kind of ugly legal trouble. But back then in 2013, 2014, he was like the most charitable player in the league. He had stayed at Stanford for an extra year to get his degree. His dad was a garbage man. He grew up in like one of the worst neighborhoods in Southern California. And he's this kid who just like, you know, really got himself out of a really tough hand he was dealt, grew into this amazing college athlete and then an amazing professional athlete, and ended up being a big centerpiece in the community that he was living in, the community he was from. And I basically just said, like, this guy's a role model. Like, he is what everybody wants sports athletes to be. And you shoved the mic in his face after he made a big play. And he said some things you didn't like. And now people are calling him thugs and all this stuff. And it's just sort of like, to me, was kind of this reflection at the time of how quickly Americans are liable to just jump on somebody, label somebody, frame them as being a really bad person based off of like a 10-second soundbite they see on Twitter or on SportsCenter or whatever else, and how this sort of attitude, this like mob mentality is leaking not just into sports, but into politics, all these other parts of our lives. That was kind of the angle that I wrote the piece from. And it was about sports, but I think it was also really, you know, political and cultural and about where society was. And it struck a nerve. It, you know, it got something like 4 or 5 million views. And it was one of the first pieces early on in my career that really brought in a following of people to my Twitter account, my own personal website, and my writing and things like that.
There is a prejudiced Twitter account, Libs of TikTok, that is focused on amplifying tweets basically to you know, either mock or potentially get people fired for espousing support for the LGBTQ community. And it was an anonymous account somewhat, right? Until today, Taylor Lorenz, a journalist for The Washington Post, formerly The New York Times, wrote an article describing a lot of things, especially that the creator of the Libs of TikTok Twitter account was at the January 6th riot insurrection. They're documenting it and then whitewashing the whole insurrection terrorist attack on our Capitol, calling it basically a BLM false flag. But on Twitter, there has been massive outrage, depending on which political ideas you have. So, Isaac, what do you think of the story that Taylor wrote and then the reaction that it's received?
First of all, I've been following Libs of TikTok. I unfollowed them. I refollowed them again today because I wanted to see how this story sort of, you know, broke down and what the account was going to say about it. I find a lot of the stuff that they post really objectionable because I think there's a sort of undercurrent of insinuations. Typically, it's LGBTQ teachers or youth talking about kind of sensitive gender issues, and there's 10-second clips or 15-second clips. Sometimes it's stuff that I'm like, wow, that's really scary. This person is a teacher. I think this ideology is a little bit extreme. Other times it's clear to me that this little snippet is kind of being taken out of context, and I can imagine a few different scenarios where, you know, this account is basically just trying to get somebody in trouble and essentially doxing or, you know, plastering someone's face to 500,000 followers, and inevitably it ends up on Fox News or whatever else. Look, I thought Taylor's piece was a good piece of journalism. I think the account is large enough and was having a big enough influence on the discourse in the media space. I think there was like total justification for someone like Taylor Lorenz to go do this story and to, you know, essentially flesh it out and go knock on doors and visit people and reach out and request for comment, which I thought was both a bad journalism. They should, if they change the article after publication, they should tell people why. And B, and I also think there's reason for some people on the right to be really critical of Taylor. I mean, I think she's doing really important journalism. I think like this piece was a good piece of journalism again. But I also can see how for people who aren't really dialed in to the kind of nuances of media or journalism ethics, seeing someone like Taylor Lorenz, who has spent a lot of time in public talking a lot about how horrible online harassment is and how bad it is to dox people and, you know, all the kind of the horrible stuff she's gone through as a reporter and her friends and family have gone through, to then see that same reporter go and flesh the story out about like a regular person who basically went viral and grew this account into a huge following. I can understand why a lot of people view that and see it in sort of a hypocritical light. I don't think that's that much of a jump. I also think, you know, a lot of people who have leveled really fair criticisms against some of Taylor's work in the past have been sort of reframed or cast as being harassers or inciting harassment of her. I struggle a little bit with the framing of her as a victim in these kinds of scenarios. She works at the New York Times, like you said, now at the Washington Post, two of the most powerful newspapers in the world, with teams of editors and lawyers behind her. And her work is fair for criticism. And if she's going to exist in the online space, I think it's okay for people to say even mean things about her work to her. That's just part of it.
The Libs of TikTok anonymous creator had the audacity to go on a media tour with Tucker Carlson and other shows as an anonymous figure. So she's trying to profit off of the public media, but yet remain anonymous. I think that there's a lot of hypocrisy there. We're seeing these, I don't know if you want to call them grifters, provocateurs, but they also run their own newsletters, like Glenn Greenwald. And they are you could call them an online influencer, a right-wing pundit, like the Post does. But they're making the story now all about Taylor instead of about the larger story at play here, the account. So when we're seeing people who have their newsletters and they're using this provocateering to make a profit, how should we view folks like Glenn Greenwald? Should we just ignore him? Should we read him to hear the argument?
Glenn Greenwald, for as long as I've been alive, has been a really critical reporter in just the global space. I mean, his stories have changed countries, they've changed laws, they've changed governments. I think the work that he did at The Intercept was really great. I read his newsletter. What I get frustrated about is that he sort of seems to take joy in being an asshole online, and that undermines, I think, both his credibility. It sort of turns people who could be allies in many of his, you know, debates and arguments into enemies. And when I agree with him about certain things, it's really frustrating for me, because then pressing agreement makes me sort of get tagged as like, oh, you're with like the asshole in the room, which you don't want to be. I think a lot of his criticisms about Taylor in particular on social media have just been like clearly a little bit over the line, gross, intended to get people to go to her account and say horrible things to her. And I referenced earlier a lot of writers who I think are kind of just repeating the same stories in different formats and kind of being, you know, reaffirmed and reaffirmed and reaffirmed by their readership, which sends them further and further down the rabbit hole they're in. I think Glenn is a great example of that. I think he's somebody who has basically spent a lot of his time recently writing about sort of culture war stuff because his readership rewards him for it, when, you know, I'm a really big fan of his actual journalism and I wish he would do more of that.
So I think, Isaac, you just kind of touched at the end there on this big question about Glenn Greenwald. Many others who were fans of his, advocates of his, have said that they won't defend his work anymore, that they think that he's a different person than he was, for example, when the Edward Snowden stories were published. But at the same time, looking at the common criticism of Glenn Greenwald today, I want to know, what do you think about this? Do you think that Glenn is the same man that he's always been? Do you think that he's changed? Do you think that he's driven by a kind of irrational antagonism in the way that he conducts work? And is this something that he's always done? What do you think about the arc of his career in this light and these kinds of criticisms?
I don't think not changing is kind of like an admirable characteristic. I think, in fact, I think the opposite. I think people who don't change over time after more experiences and more input are probably doing something wrong. So the fact that he's changed, I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. I do think that he has sort of latched on to a little bit of the online grievance culture. I mean, I remember even a few years ago when he was talking and writing and tweeting openly about how Twitter was bad for him and poisonous for some of the dialogue. And, you know, he felt himself acting in a less appropriate or admirable manner online because of how much time he was spending on Twitter. And then he sort of just like never did anything about it, based on what I've seen. And I think that part of it is sad and unfortunate. I know if Glenn were listening to this, he would not want my, first of all, he wouldn't care about my opinion. He probably wouldn't want my empathy. And I think he would find it kind of condescending that talking about him in that way, but that's my honest assessment of it. I think he gets rewarded in the space that he operates in now when he is sort of taking these kind of mean and cruel dunk fire-breathing takes on people. I think that gives him more clout in the circles that he's operating in now. And I think that's pretty unfortunate. He still does a lot of good journalism. And I think a lot of the pieces he writes are still really important. I think he's gotten a lot of things right, even in the last couple of years, about mistakes the media was making or how mainstream stories were playing out in sort of absurd ways. You know, specifically, I think he's done a really good job of writing about the intelligence agencies in the United States and how so many, you know, former intel officials are now becoming pundits, and how the American public has just sort of swallowed stuff like that wholesale, despite all the obvious ethical issues and conflicts of interest. So there's a lot of stuff of his work that I find really valuable and in line with stuff he's done previously. But there's no doubt to me that his online personality has gotten sort of this meaner, crueler, angrier edge to it that I think in a lot of ways does a disservice to his work. I think it makes it easy for people to dismiss the really important writing that he does or the important critiques that he levels about people.
When you're referring to the major critics of Tendler and Lorenz in the media, someone who comes to mind is the New York Times' own talisman, and that's Maggie Haberman. Maggie Haberman is someone who's often really been part of the story in a true sense, where events, especially they're happening in the Trump White House, were actually motivated by her own presence sort of in the room, where many of these figures in the White House that were pursuing these antagonisms and rivalries against each other were driven by the knowledge that their rivals or enemies were talking to Maggie, and that the way Maggie's coverage was impacting the way that they went about doing their jobs. However, she has very much avoided making herself part of the story in the way that she draws the narrative. So what do you think about that, Isaac? Do you think that that's fair, a way of characterizing those two figures? And do you think that they represent an opposite approach?
I do think that they represent a little bit of an opposite approach. If I remember correctly, what Maggie was basically saying was that her and Taylor don't go about journalism in the same way. And that generally speaking, you know, reporters shouldn't make these pieces about themselves. They shouldn't be trying to create their own brands, that sort of thing. You know, I'm certainly partial more to Maggie's work. I think points on that though. One is Maggie gets a ton of criticism too. I mean, she gets hammered by people on the left and the right for her stories all the time. She's also the subject of lots of online abuse. I think she does a much better job of either not engaging it or not sort of framing herself as the victim in her reporting. I think she kind of just takes it on the chin and moves forward, which a lot of reporters do. And I think the second thing is just that as great and important as Maggie's journalism is, and I think generally speaking, when you're a reporter who's covering the White House and having conversations with the president, in my opinion, that kind of work is more important than covering TikTok or internet trends like Taylor does in terms of like the impact it's going to have on society as a whole. I think you could maybe make an argument either way, but that's just my personal opinion. I think, you know, how the government works and what the president does is really basically like the most important thing in the country right now. The sort of downside of that is Maggie does insider journalism. You know, I mean, she is very close to her subjects and close to the product as well. And there are all sorts of different conflicts of interest that come up there, even when she's not totally visible. I mean, the really basic and obvious and classic one is like, if Maggie Haberman pisses off Donald Trump, will he answer her phone calls anymore? What does it mean if she violates his trust in some way as the source for a story? And how does that play out? And how does she handle those sort of conflicts? So I think Maggie is a more seasoned journalist. I think she carries herself online in a way that I find more admirable. And I think she's done, you know, a lot more important work in terms of stories that have shaped the country and society as a whole. But, you know, I also think Taylor represents a sort of new breed of journalists that are coming up too. And they're going to be a part of this space going forward. And people who consume their content are going to want to understand the differences and you know, how to view both those kinds of journalism.
With the rise of Substack, there's been all of this attention on the newsletter as its own form, apart from, you know, a blog or a column. I just kind of wanted to hear from you, Isaac. How do you see a newsletter as a concept? Do you think that it's clearly distinct from something like a blog or a column? What actually makes a newsletter a newsletter?
Well, I think, first of all, I've done pretty much every kind of format that there is in terms of media production, you know, blog post, article, investigative, long form, podcast, newsletter, pretty much name it. And I've at least dabbled in it a little bit. And for me, newsletters are by far the best format and the best platform I've ever worked in. First of all, they're really direct. They're, you know, it's like a B2C format. You're going straight to a customer, a consumer who's reading your content. You land in their inbox. It's kind of intimate. It's 1v1. So when they're reading your stuff, it feels like they're getting it just from you. And I think a lot of newsletters sort of leverage that by making things a little bit more personal. I definitely do. In my politics newsletter, I summarize the left's argument about the major story of the day, the right's argument about the major story of the day, and then I give my take. And that gives it sort of a personal flavor. And I also try and just be more open and personal in the piece than I might, definitely than I would be in a reported out article that I was submitting to, you know, a news outlet as a freelance piece. I sort of reference myself more and more open about my personal life. And I think that sort of builds a connection with readers. Specifically to politics, I've found that newsletters are so incredible because there's no audience for the interaction. It's not Twitter. It's not Facebook. It's not a comment section. When people reply to you, there's no motivation for them to sort of virtue signal or to be, you know, mean or to dunk on you. Most of the time you get emails and notes from people that sometimes are angry at first, but if you reply in like a cool and measured way, turn into really productive conversations, and oftentimes are just really honest and forthright. And I find like the discourse is so much more elevated than it is on other platforms I've been on because people aren't watching. People feel like it's a private space where they can tell you what they honestly think. They can sort of write in a longer form. It's not a character limit like places like Twitter. All of that stuff has made newsletters, I think, for me, by far the most enjoyable platform I've ever worked on. All that being said, I don't think they're ever going to really replace, you know, other traditional forms of media. I think they function really well as an additional format for people to get their news. The New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and Fox News and CNN and NBC and CBS, these places are all going to be producing really important news and driving a lot of coverage, I think, for at least the next decade. But these newsletters are, you know, they give people an opportunity to distribute content in a way that can't be really moderated or regulated by other people, that goes directly to somebody's inbox, that sort of creates this personal relationship. And I think that's a really powerful tool and a really important addition to the discourse and the media space out there. And for me personally, it's exciting to be on the ground floor of.
So if you're picking one news story a day, really, to communicate to the audience, do you kind of, and this is something we're also thinking about too, because we, you know, pick news stories to focus on as we do this program. Do you generally try to fit into the expectations of what those readers are trying to learn about, you know, knowing that they have these interests? Or do you often pick stories that you think that they might not otherwise know about or know that they should be interested in, if you understand what I mean? Like, are you trying to bring things to their attention that they might not otherwise know or care about? How are you balancing between those two things?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I have a staff of part-time people that help me with Tangle, and story selection to me is maybe the most important part of what we're doing, because story selection itself is a, you know, an expression of bias. And so I am really, really careful about the stories that I choose to cover and really thoughtful about them, because I basically don't want to kind of just cover things that people on the left are interested in, or just cover things that government nerds are interested in, or just cover things that culture war people are interested in. I want to do a really diverse set of content, which is really hard to do. And so my answer to your question is, I kind of try and spread it out and hit different notes on a regular basis. You know, if I've covered back-to-back days on bills that are in Congress, then on the third day, I'll maybe try and cover something that's a little more like political, cultural, maybe something like the Disney issue, or with like the LGBTQ bill in Florida. You know, that's like a good example of a story that is both kind of legislative, but also became a real cultural flashpoint. But it's not like a wonky, what's the $1.9 trillion bill that just passed Congress going to do to, I don't know, the EPA or something like that. So I really try and mix it up in that regard. I also do things like I poll my readers. I just ask them what they want to know about. And sometimes I get responses that I don't like and I ignore them. And sometimes I get responses that I do like and I go for them. But I try and make them a part of the conversation, because I do want to cover stuff they're interested in. And I do want to know what they're sort of, you know, what's sort of getting through the ether and what's happening outside my bubble. But in order to produce the content that I do, there is one functional thing, at least for the Monday through Thursday newsletter, which is the free part of the newsletter I do. Every Friday, I publish a subscribers only edition that's for paying subscribers. But Monday through Thursday is like the debate format, which is main topic, what the left says, what the right says, my take. And in order to produce that, the bare minimum is there have to be people out there talking about the story. So it's got to be out there in the kind of media ecosystem a little bit already. There have to be some columns about it, or some podcasts about it, or some TV hits about it. That way I have some competing arguments to present. So that's really the number one parameter, is just it needs to be something that there's a debate happening around. And obviously in today's political world, that's not a really hard thing to find. But it is really the only functional thing that must happen for me to cover it in that Monday through Thursday newsletter.
Do you think in a media ecosystem where most people are profiting off of polarizing information, getting content out there to very siloed groups that is very inflammatory, that and I ask this as somebody running a centrist media project, I think in a lot of ways similar to yours, just in podcast interview form, do you think a centrist project is actually viable and scalable? And if so, why?
Yeah, absolutely, I do. I mean, the number one reason why is because Tangle's working. If you asked me when I started this project 2.5 years ago, I would have said, you know, I have no idea, but I hope to God it works, because I really wanted it to work. And I really believed in kind of the mission orientation of what we were doing, where we were trying to bring a diverse group of people under one news roof and really expose them to ideas that they might not like, while also seeing ideas that felt like they represented their own views. And it's been a huge success. I mean, where we're at now is beyond my wildest dreams. 35,000 subscribers, over 5,000 paying subscribers. We've had several newsletters and editions go viral. We have tons of people who subscribe who are, you know, working in Congress or are big mainstream journalists with followings much bigger than mine. And then we have, you know, people in 40 countries outside the US and tens of thousands of people who are just regular Americans or international folks trying to understand American politics, which is mostly what we cover. So I know that there's a demand for it. I see it every day. I hear from people every day who say, I've been looking for this for so long, and I'm so glad to finally find it. So in that regard, I'm very confident in it. I think polling, we have an abundance of polling, and we have for a long time, that suggests people who identify as independents are still one of the largest blocks of voters, if not today, now the largest block of voters in America. Now, as you well know, and doing your work in politics, people who say they're independent oftentimes are, you know, they're independent, but they voted only for Republicans in every election for the last 20 years. But the fact that people identify that way, even if they may end up the way it comes out in the wash, is they end up voting one way or the other, you know, 95% of the time, I think is really important. And I think it's a really understated thing. I think it's a representation of both the fact people either don't want to be attached to a party label, or they want to maintain their own independence, or they really do view themselves as being kind of centrist or moderate or somewhere in the middle. And I think that's evidence of the fact that a lot of Americans see a lot of good or see a lot of rationale from both sides of the political aisle they can attach themselves to. And then finally, I just say, you know, there seems to me, and I've been talking about this actually recently in my newsletter, to be a kind of undercurrent that I'm encountering more and more of people who are just like, are tired. They're just tired of being angry. They're tired of hating the Trump guy who lives next to them. They're tired of hating their daughter for being a really progressive, you know, non-gender conforming liberal. They're just like tired of it. And they want to understand why people feel the way that they feel. And I hear from these people every day. I hear from, you know, 17-year-old kids who are like, I hate my uncle. I don't want to hate him. How can I talk to him about this issue? I hear from grandparents who are worried that their kids are communists, and they, you know, my newsletters help them understand the left's position better. They're out there. And I think, like, you know, neither side wants to put their arms down first, but there seems to me to be this sense that we've kind of hit rock bottom in the political discourse. I think people know that. I think events like January 6th and the first presidential debate in 2020 sort of tip people off to the fact that we were sort of careening out of control. They're hungry for something better. And I think that's a growing and growing group of Americans. And that gives me a little bit of hope and some belief that the demand is definitely out there.
We agree with you from everything that we've seen so far as well. And I think another thing that's interesting that you hit on a little bit is the people in the game, the journalists, the staff, the members of Congress, they want to be a part of stuff like this, whether it's consuming it or, for example, coming on our show and having those more in-depth but yet less hyperbolic conversations, because they get to then get into the issues and explain things to people honestly, as opposed to just having to hit on these talking points. But I digress.
So we're going to go to Jennifer for another question.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Justin. Hi, Isaac. Hey, so my question is going to go back to a little bit of how you were describing newsletters and sort of community news. I heard a story recently on like uses of Discord and Reddit and other things as more of a social proof. You know who is reporting it, and so they're, even though they're reporting maybe onto specific issues or with a specific bias, you know who they are and why they're doing it. Are you to your comment that we've always had newsletters and they go up and down? Do you see this current up of newsletters as just another sort of wave there, or do you see it as more meaningful in that it is this sort of social proof thing that people are kind of tying to where society is going?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think that the way the online landscape is shaking out is that a lot more independent creators are building smaller and more loyal audiences than you might get from major institutional media outlets. And that's not just politics. It's happening in sports journalism. It's happening in arts, culture, food, basically every kind of traditional beat that you would see in an old newspaper 50 years ago has now been kind of bifurcated into these different segments of, you know, newsletters, podcasts, whatever. And I think that's here to stay. I mean, I think some people are going to be more prone to seek out that kind of independence. I certainly cannot ever imagine going back to working for a news organization or under an editor now that I've sort of tasted the freedom of what it's like to be able to say what I want and be my own boss. But there's tons of downsides to it. I mean, I don't get any days off really unless I decide that the newsletter is not going to come out. I have less of a sort of collegial work experience. You know, I don't get the institutional support of like health insurance or lawyers or anything like that that I would get from being at a major media organization. And so for a lot of people, that's, you know, that's not worth the trade-off. So I sort of see a world where I think we're at the beginning, maybe not the beginning, but I think we're about maybe halfway through this big evolution of a blossoming independent media culture. And I think it's going to keep growing in the near term. But I think at some point, it's just going to turn into a space that's really dominated and hard to break into. And there will be like, you know, a few thousand really big independent creators and a couple hundred really big media websites or news outlets or whatever in your given sports and politics and topics like that. And I think people are just going to go to the ones that they really like and use a mix of them kind of like they're doing now. But I think newsletters for sure are here to stay because I think email is pretty much unbreakable. People are going to use it forever for work, for, you know, long form personal messages, for starting forwarding chains, for sharing family news. I think it's just going to keep being a thing that everybody uses. And as long as people use email, I think newsletters will exist in a really powerful way in the media space.
We will go to Andy for our last question. Then we'll probably kick it over to Ike or Isaac or whatever you want to call him for last thoughts. Andy, over to you.
Thanks, Justin. Many thanks for joining us today, Isaac. Great to hear from you. Here in the UK, we are just in the process of introducing an online safety bill. Actually, just went through Parliament for its second reading today, in fact. And this is seeking to address, through government legislation, many of the points that have arisen today around the balance between, for instance, freedom of expression versus, let's say, misinformation, disinformation, or indeed the potential for individuals, organizations to cause real life harm through things like doxing, revenge porn, all of these sorts of online, the terrible things that happen. So what I wonder, and obviously this feeds into the email format, feeds into the regulation, self-regulation, even of the tech platforms. I wonder if we could get your opinion on the likely success, potential success of governments regulating the media, obviously setting aside cases like Russia and China, and whether or not, regardless of whether they're likely to be successful or not, I'm sorry, whether it's actually a good and moral thing for a government to do in regulating the media in today's modern online information environment. Many thanks.
Yeah, it's another great question. I am very, very, very reluctant and concerned anytime government entities are interested in regulating the media. First of all, I think the people that really need to be taking these kinds of steps are the platforms. I think the first question sort of touched on this a little bit, that, you know, Twitter is an independent platform. It can kind of do what it wants. I tend to hold that view too. I think Twitter has a larger responsibility being a sort of, you know, the modern day town square that it has to appease to some kind of balance in the decisions that it's making, but it is a private platform. The issue that, you know, I think is really important when you talk about or think about government regulation is that what you want is a world where a maximum number of people can participate in the discourse in a way that's, you know, safe, quote unquote. And I don't mean that in like a safe space. That's not what I'm talking about. Not like the liberal or progressive version of this that like you don't need to hear anything that maybe hurts your feelings or whatever. I mean it in the sense that someone's freedom of speech is inhibited if they can't participate in the town square because they are receiving tons of abuse. So you don't have the freedom of speech to just mob mentality verbally assault somebody that you see in the street. You can certainly say things that they don't want to hear and talk about whatever you want in front of them without repercussions, but you also can't cross certain lines even in that real world space. And in the internet space, we need some of that too. We need to protect people from that kind of abuse in certain ways with, you know, rules on platforms and things like that. Because if someone is being harassed to the point that they can't functionally, you know, participate in a conversation, then it's those people whose freedom of speech is being inhibited. And so it's this kind of balance that we have to find. Traditionally speaking, I don't think the government has been pretty good at that. I don't think when we give the government a lot of leash to do that, they tend to make well-reasoned decisions around how to regulate speech. I think given the importance of speech in order to criticize our governing bodies, the idea that they would be able to make the rules about how we go about doing that is deeply concerning to me. It's not something that I would ever feel comfortable with. I think, you know, just generally speaking, it seems much better to me if the platforms are the ones who are dictating how these conversations are happening. The government in America, I'm less familiar with the United Kingdom's laws, but it already does regulate speech in certain ways. You know, the freedom of speech is not, and you know, this kind of immutable thing. There are certain limits to it, and I think those limits, as they exist now, are the way that they should be. I think the spaces where we really need to improve is platforms fairly and evenly applying the rules that they've created so there isn't a big imbalance in how people are being treated on them.
I just want to thank you for coming on, and just if you had any quick last thoughts that you wanted to leave us with.
No, I mean, I would just say if you are somebody who is interested in American politics, I would definitely check out Tangle, readtangle.com. The link is there. We are doing our best to get people out of their bubbles. Every issue, you're going to see views that you agree with, views that you don't agree with. And that's kind of the point. We're hoping to widen people's political views and understanding and, you know, just basically get people in front of ideas that they may not otherwise encounter. So that's our goal. I think we're doing something that's fairly unique in the space, and we're growing really quickly because of it. And the more people who are listening to podcasts like this and interested in American politics that are reading, the better.
That is all we have for you today. Again, huge thanks to Isaac Saul, to Tangle, to our audience for their questions, and most of all, to you for being here. As a reminder, like all of our episodes, this is an edited version of a longer conversation that was taped live with audience questions. For information about how to join us and past episodes, please visit our website, pm101.live. Please also take a second to subscribe on whichever streaming service you're using right now so you don't miss our next episode this Monday, featuring Mvemba Dizolole, who's the director of the Africa program at CSIS. This has been Politics and Media 101, produced in partnership with Clubhouse. Wherever you are in the world, thank you for being a part of this community. I'm Jeff Browning. On behalf of Justin Higgins and John Gunnison, our co-founders, thank you very much for being here.